Stay tuned now for Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, the collaborative series between 98.7 WFMT, Chicago Magazine, and the Looking Glass Theater Company in the Water Tower Waterworks. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by MavenChronicles.com. Let them take you somewhere, and by Seminary Co-op Bookstores. For readers, the Seminary Co-op Bookstores are a literary slice of heaven, because this consumer-owned bookstore is actually three Chicago bookstores. The flagship store at 5757 South University Avenue, widely regarded as one of the world's best academic bookstores, carries about 200,000 titles. Currently, they recommend Your Inner Fish, A Journey into the 3.5 Billion-Year History of the Human Body by Neil Shubin, published by Pantheon. 57th Street Books at 1301 East 57th Street is a charming neighborhood bookstore that's featuring Sarah Paretsky's Bleeding Kansas, published by G.P. Putnam's, and the Newberry Library Bookshop at 60 West Walton specializes in cartography, music, history, cards, gifts, and more. Discover Mapping Manifest Destiny, Chicago and the American West by Michael Konzen and Diane Dillon, published by the Newberry Library. Enjoy Seminary Co-op Bookstore's 10% member discounts, worldwide shipping, special order services, and author events. Seminary Co-op Bookstores, three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456 and semcoop.com. Victoria Lautman's guest today is Russell Banks, whose book, The Reserve, will be the topic of discussion. We go now to the stage of the Looking Glass Theater. Here is Victoria Lautman.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. Wow, that cold weather really does it for people. Thank you for coming to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. As you know, this is a collaboration with Chicago Magazine, WFMT Radio, here at Looking Glass Theater, where we are live on stage on the set of Hephaestus, a Greek mythology circus tale. It's only on view till March 9th, so if you haven't got tickets, it's almost sold out, I think. This is the fourth and final season of Writers on the Record, and we are thrilled that this season has been supported by the MavenChronicles.com. And we still have a great season up ahead. I'll give you details about that at the break. And I also want to remind people that during the last 15 minutes or so of the show, I urge you to ask questions. When do you get to ask questions of somebody like Russell Banks? It's extraordinary. So take advantage of it. He's lived a long and interesting life, and he could advise you about practically anything, by the way. It doesn't have to be about his book. Actually, this is an interesting thing to try at home when you go home later, because I know you're not going to believe this. But if you Google the words, or whatever search engine you like, most important living white male author. Yes, his name comes up. You have to use exactly those words. It has to be living, not dead. But if you Google that, the name Russell Banks appears. And I think this is courtesy of a obviously smitten reviewer from The Village Voice several years ago. Whether or not you agree or disagree with that assessment, it really doesn't matter, because it's there on the internet in perpetuity. So anybody saying most important living white male author, bang, Russell Banks. That's fantastic. Perhaps Russell Banks planted it there. I don't know. We can get to that. But Banks, at 67 years old, if we look at the facts to back up this claim of this reviewer, he is the author of an astounding 18 books. That includes 11 novels. There's poetry, short story collections, nonfiction. You might know that Continental Drift and Cloud Splitter were each finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. The novels Affliction and The Sweet Hereafter became best-selling movies. There are four more movies in the works right now. Once the writer strike is over, Russell himself will begin getting back on that wagon. But his 11th novel, The Reserve, is why we're here today on Writers on the Record. This is something of an atmospheric departure for Russell Banks. It's set in 1936 in the Adirondacks. And there is a cast of characters in this book who you will not soon forget. It is a wonderful pleasure to welcome Russell Banks. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I think they're all clapping their hands to warm them up. And,
25
break the
below.
Ice off their hands.
That's right. It's working. Yeah. This is a book that, and I didn't realize until I compared my advanced reader's edition to the actual hard copy of the book. There's actually a preamble that you include, or an epilogue or something, in the reader's edition, which talks about the historical stew that kind of made up the premise for this book. We have got a very specific time in history set against the Spanish Civil War. The Hindenburg is in there. There's references to Hemingway and Dos Passos. And we have figures who are inspired by, characters who are inspired by actual figures. A woman who had an affair with Hemingway, the artist Rockwell Kent. And so even though a lot of your books in the past have had historical references, this book seemed to have been bringing them in from a much wider group of sources. And I was curious about what part of this actually began the book in your mind.
Good question. I'm not sure. You know, I wrote those notes at the behest of my editor, who I think was trying to manipulate and control reviewers and booksellers in some way and guide them into how to read the book, because the book is a departure from previous books. And if you read this book through the lens of, say, Affliction or Cloud Splitter or Sweet Hereafter, one of those books which are really kind of grim and are more oriented in the working class and oppressed people of the country than this is, they might misread this. And so I think my editor was trying to do me a favor. The trouble is, I wrote the notes right after finishing the book, which is a time when the author knows almost nothing about the book whatsoever and hasn't had a chance to really step back and look at it and say, now, where the heck did that come from? So I was taking a shot at it. The truth is, there is a lot of history and historical event and characters that that I tried to bring into the novel as a way of building a context, really. At the center of it is a romantic and tragic love affair, two of them, in fact, and four characters living sort of small lives, as it were, or domestic lives that are coming apart. But there is a background, just as there is for us in this, you know, today, sitting here. We all have our private lives, our domestic lives, and so forth, but we also, there's a war going on out there. There's historically significant election going on. There's a lot going on, but, you know, behind us that's casting shadows and meaning across our day-to-day lives as well. And most novels kind of leave that out. They either concentrate on one or the other. You know, either it's a historical novel about the times, or it's a domestic novel about individuals and locked into their little private dramas. And I was trying to bring both together because it was set in 1936. That was the year the Spanish Civil War erupted. The Hindenburg was crossing the Atlantic. It was the Concorde of its time. We know, of course, in 1937, a year later, there were tragic consequences of that, just as there were for the Spanish Civil War. So I was casting a shadow of history, I guess, across it. Go ahead.
Well, also, the other character in the book, besides the two main characters, who are these kind of archetypal ones, a kind of nut femme fatale beauty, the other one is a Renaissance man artist, and both of these are based on, or somewhat inspired by actual characters. But the third, I think, really important character in the book isn't even a human being. It is the place, the location of the reserve set in the Adirondacks, and this is both the backdrop for this really complicated, turgid plot involving, you know, affairs and sex and murders and fires and lobotomies, and there's like really a lot going on.
There's a lot.
And that's just the tip of it. But the reserve is the setting for that, and it's also kind of the matrix that holds it all together, because that is a place, which I want you to describe, which is actual... It's actually a place that sets up a class system between the locals and these rich WASPs that come there.
Right. It's a sublimely beautiful and pristine wilderness, 6 million acres set aside in upstate New York, and with little villages sort of laced through it. It's an area the size of the whole state of Vermont, and most people aren't really aware of it. Mountains, lakes, rivers, it's absolutely splendid. And in the late 19th, early 20th century, grandees, wealthy grandees from Manhattan, Philadelphia, and New England started coming up there and building what they called their camps, or great camps, these faux rustic palaces, really, and buying up large plots of this land and setting it aside in, for their private reserves. And in the process, the local people, especially during the Depression era when the mills went out and lumbering went out and all the capital fled, the local people became a kind of servant class. So there was this great divide that that occurred in what had been previously a fairly integrated, economically integrated community or region. And that exists even to today. I mean, we're not talking about something that only happened in the 30s, but it exists to a considerable degree today. But it exists all the way across the country. I mean, it exists in Montana, you know, where people are flying in private planes and buying up vast tracts of land. It exists in the islands off South Carolina and Georgia. And every beautiful spot in North America has this kind of class divide rising and turning one group of people into a servant class and the other group of people into the grandees who control and reserve and preserve the place at the same time.
Well, Vanessa Cole, who kind of sets the plot in motion, we're going to meet her in just a moment, who is the daughter of one of the most privileged families in this place, the reserve, and mm-hmm. their grandparents, who were like basically the Vanderbilts and mm-hmm. the Whitneys and people who were part of the original establishment mm-hmm. of that kind of area. She meets up with Jordan Groves, the artist, and what's interesting about him, actually, you know what, before we even get into that, why don't you read from when they mm-hmm. first meet? And you realized right in the first couple of pages of the book that even before we've met Jordan, even before we've seen his face, we know that sparks are going to fly with these two.
Yeah, trouble's coming. She's standing at the edge of the lake in a kind of Nordic mood, you know, looking out over the lake as the sun is going down. And her family and their guests are standing on a deck a little bit of a distance away, watching the sunset in this glorious spot. And she hears a light intermittent drone that rose and fell, surged and lapsed back almost into silence, and then returned and grew louder. She realized that it was an airplane. She had never before heard or seen an airplane at the Second Lake. Rangeview was the largest of only a half dozen rough-hewn log camps, a few of which were elaborately luxurious, located in the 40,000-acre privately owned wilderness, the Tamarack Wilderness Reserve. Vanessa's grandfather Cole had been one of the original shareholders. When shareholders in the reserve, members they were called, or their invited guests flew up from Boston or New York City in a private airplane, which they sometimes did, as it was a long, arduous day trip on the Delaware and Hudson train to Westport and by automobile from there. They came up the Hudson Valley and flew in from Lake Champlain north of the mountain called Goliath. They landed their airplane in a broad mowed pasture over in the village of Tunbridge, 3 miles west, where they were met by a car sent from the reserve clubhouse, so that an internal combustion engine was never heard, nor an airplane seen inside or above the reserve itself, or even above the Tamarack clubhouse and golf course. The mountains and forests and the lakes and the streams were held for the exclusive use and enjoyment of members and their guests, most of whom, at least those who did not have their own camp on the Second Lake, stayed at the grand hotel-like clubhouse and the cottages that surrounded it. The mountains and forests and lakes and streams were off-limits to strangers, to tourists, and the inhabitants of the several hamlets in the region, except, of course, for the local people, lucky enough to be employed by the members at their camps or at the associated clubhouse, cottages, golf course, as servants, caretakers, cooks, caddies, and guides. They were allowed onto the reserve and club grounds, but only to work, and not to fish or hunt or hike on their own. Now Vanessa could hear the airplane clearly and steadily. Though she could not see it, she knew it was coming in from the north, flying low, tracing the Tamarack River to the first lake and on to its headwaters here at the second. Suddenly the airplane appeared in the northern sky, just above a line of black silhouetted spruce trees. It was rising in the distance, over the water quickly, its gleaming belly exposed to the waning sun, as if the pilot had decided to take in the view of the entire lake and surrounding mountains and the darkening sky, when she heard the engine cut back. The airplane, a pale gray biplane with scarlet trim and two open cockpits, a goggled, hatless pilot in the forward cockpit, the other empty, slowed there, seeming almost to pause in flight and hover, when it banked to the west, heading toward the mountain wall that plunged straight into the glittering water. It was a seaplane with two large pontoons, and she thought she was watching a man about to crash his airplane deliberately against the 1,000-foot vertical slab of gray granite, and she forgot her cold thoughts and grew almost excited, for she had never seen anyone kill himself, and realized that in some small way she'd always wanted to, and was surprised by it. The pilot seemed about to smash the airplane against the rock face of the mountain when less than 100 yards from it he banked hard to the left, dipped the wings back to horizontal, cut the engine speed nearly to stopping, and swiftly descended toward the water. The airplane touched down at the far side of the lake, broke the surface, and slid into the water, unfolding high fans of silver spray behind the pontoons. Vanessa was relieved, of course, but felt a flicker of disappointment, too.
Russell Banks reading from his new book, The Reserve. Well, you realize Vanessa's desire to see somebody kill themselves is our first indication that she's a character whose cheese isn't entirely on her cracker, as it were.
Yeah.
And It's kind of part of the awareness of the book that you realize that, yes, there's a difference between madcap and insane and sociopathic.
Right. Yeah, I mean, her behavior, what I was trying to get to is sort of a kind of person, a woman, that in literature and in films is usually portrayed in a satiric or condescending way, either as, yeah, a slightly ditzy madcap person, or a narcissistic and totally self-absorbed and unreliable person who's manipulative and controlling and so on. You know, in a clinical way, I guess we could call them borderline personality disorder or narcissistic. And, you know, many of us, and include myself here, have either been in love with such a person or married to such a person or the child of such a person or even the parent or sibling of such a person. And we know the charm and the beauty of such a person, but we also know the danger of them and the difficulty of living with them. In literature, I can only think of two instances where such a person was presented sympathetically. Female. Males are actually presented sympathetically that way often, but with admiration, self-absorbed, manipulative, controlling, etc. But females are usually done differently, except for Madame Bovary. If you think about her, would you want to be married to Madame Bovary? No, but we view her with great sympathy. And then there's a great story by Chekhov called The Darling, which is about a similar type of woman. And I was trying to get inside such a person and see her sympathetically without sentimentalizing her or idealizing her, but not judging her either, and see her as a wounded person so that her behavior, what's observable about her, has a cause, a deep psychological wound that goes all the way back to childhood and gets reinforced throughout her life, so that she's in a way trapped in a very painful and difficult way, a way that, you know, most psychiatrists and psychologists will say is impossible to treat.
When she encounters Jordan, who isn't insane, he's not a sociopath, he's just a very self-involved,
yeah,
macho, very talented individual, mm-hmm, who's married to a woman a little younger than he is, who was his student in college, and they have two sons, Bear and Wolf. And
that tells you a lot about the father who named them Bear and Wolf.
Bear, yes. And Wolf. And yeah, he's kind of like nature man in a way. But he is such an interesting character in this book. And I know that Rockwell Kent occupied the same sort of slice of life, which is straddling this really odd chasm,
yeah,
between the classes, born in one class, but dealing really exclusively with the other. And by virtue of the success he's gotten through his artwork, right, manages to be part of that class. Although this is the first moment when Jordan lands that plane that he's ever set foot in the reserve.
Right, right. No, he's, you know, you mentioned Rockwell Kent, and it's true. Rockwell Kent was in some ways the basis for Jordan Groves, especially this aspect of him. He was a man of the radical left in the 1930s and 40s. Well, he died in 72. He stayed a man of the radical left all his life. And was at the same time one of the most famous artists and successful artists in the world. And I started thinking about that inherent conflict between being a person of the left who identifies with and sympathizes with the working people, the poor, the oppressed, and so forth, but whose clientele, whose social milieu, whose world is, and whose support comes from the very class that his politics attack. And this is a kind of a peculiarity, I think, of American intellectual and artistic life. And we see it very clearly in the 1930s with Hemingway, Dos Passos, Rockwell Kent, Edmund Wilson, people like that. But we see it today, too. We see it, you know, you see it with E.L. Doctorow or any number of leftists, Susan Sontag, if you want, Russell Banks, if you want. But this is not an unusual conflict, but it's one that's rarely examined. Because it's the person who experiences it is a little embarrassed by it most of the time. I mean, you know, Doctorow, who is a great champion of the poor and the working class, of course, has a wonderful home in the Hamptons, and travels in a certain circle. I have a great home up in Saratoga Springs and in the Adirondacks. I live in a building not unlike, you know, Rangeview in some ways as camp. So this is a conflict in the life of an American artist and intellectual that isn't easily resolved. And I wanted to explore that. I wanted to think about it. You know, fiction writing is a way of thinking that you can't do with philosophy or journalism or history. It's a unique way of thinking. And I wanted to think about that.
Well, it's interesting because people who have read a lot of your works will always look for your character or your upbringing. You're from this working class roots and a very violent background and were the responsible one in your family and went on to become incredibly successful, the first person in your family to attend college and Phi Beta Kappa, the whole schmear. And so thinking about that, and people look at Affliction and any number of your earlier books and look for the character of Russell Banks, and then knowing that you collect the works of Rockwell Kent and his first edition and his book, his woodcuts, his character, do we try and read any of you into that, or is that just a stupid, specious way of approaching a book?
No, it's a kind of natural and inevitable one, I think, at least while the author is still a living white male.
Most important.
Once they're dead, it doesn't matter so much, I suppose. But yeah, it is, but not really. You know, you start with, it's like you start with this little opening a door and walking into a room, but the room is dark once you get inside. The door is, yes, that conflict I might feel, I see Rockwell Kent feels and so forth. But once I'm inside the room of fiction, the world of fiction, then things start to change. And this character, Jordan Groves, is a much more self-absorbed person, much more self-confident. He's, I think, less conscious of his own inner life and its meaning than I am. These are conflicts that Jordan Groves, that I was just describing, that Jordan Groves himself doesn't acknowledge. He's in a kind of denial about that. And so he becomes more interesting to me than I am to me as a result, you know.
You have had this book described by several reviewers as a kind of contemporary postmodern noir book, and that's a description that you really have appreciated and like. And I went and looked up what that even meant. Like, what is noir fiction? We all kind of have an idea of noir film. And the idea that this sort of derives from the more hard-boiled fiction that is real crime, serious crime, pulp fiction type stuff, and that noir is more kind of has more almost sexual subtext, that there's always a thriller aspect, that whoever has committed a crime may not even be aware that they committed the crime. How aware were you when you were writing this book that you were adopting that kind of a noir mode, and was this something that you only realized afterwards? It was something that you were trying to push the envelope by adopting this new sort of voice?
Well, once I elected to write, set the story in 1936, 37, and I was influenced by, certainly, the life and times of people like Rockwell Kenton and Ernest Hemingway's To Have and To Have Not. I went back and reread that novel he wrote in 1936, which was also dealing with class. And then I started thinking about James M. Cain. And you move into a time frame and a locale when you start a novel, and its ambiance becomes yours. Its mood and atmosphere of that time becomes mine. I start imagining these characters in their clothes, you know, and what kind of clothes they wore. And then pretty soon I'm thinking the cars that they were driving, and the whole world starts to emerge in my imagination out of that. And language comes with that. The voice of those kinds of narrators. I could hear all those Dashiell Hammett novels in the background, that nice, sharp, edgy dialogue between the men and the women, particularly. The shadow that falls across everything, even when the sun is bright, you know, there's some darkness of what you're aware of, whether it's in Los Angeles or New York or in a rural environment like this. So I was aware of it fairly early on. And, this, you know, the opening sequence of scenes there, I read one of them for you. You see right away a femme fatale. Those novels always start with the appearance of a beautiful, slightly confused and threatened woman who you can tell as soon as she meets this well-intended guy who likes to solve other people's problems, she's going to screw up his life. You could tell that in the opening scene. Usually it takes place in a private detective office. I had it take place in a lake with a plane, but it's the same kind of encounter, you know. So I knew pretty much once I got rolling that that was the world I was going to deal with. And there are certain aspects of fiction that really don't belong there, like, you know, cutting away to Hindenburg, the Spanish Civil War, and building that frame around it.
Well, and what you're referring to, which we'll hear that second reading in the second half of the program, but it's not just a straight linear narrative, which is the other part of it, that it's so, like, finely layered, and we find ourselves in a kind of a zigzag mode. There's these italic blocks, another formal device to show us what's happening in the future. It takes us a while to even realize who we're dealing with, that these are actually the characters in the future that we've been reading about in this present tense. Mm-hmm. And so you give us a view of what's about to happen. It's a complicated structure to do that.
Mm-hmm. It is, but, you know, it's not that innovative, really. I bet you many of the people in your audience are very familiar with John Dos Passos' USA trilogy, where he collages fiction and nonfiction and jumps all over the place in time and so forth. He basically made that technique his own, but it's certainly one that since then writers have borrowed from and learned from. So I wasn't really doing anything particularly radical, although I think it does, at first, it takes a few sentences into it to realize, wait a minute, this isn't where I was, and this is, in fact, a year later, and so on. But what I was trying to do, too, is telescope what was going to happen to these characters down the line and to draw them into that larger historical context that I was mentioning earlier, that, you know, you can't live outside that. You can't live outside history. We all, on some level and in some inescapable way, are in history.
On that ponderous note, we're going to take a little break here, and we'll be back in just a couple minutes with Writers on the Record. I'm Victoria Lautman. Thank you.
You're listening to 98.7 WFMT Chicago and to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, a series featuring conversations with noteworthy authors who've published recent works of fiction or nonfiction. This local broadcast is made possible in part by MavenChronicles.com. Let them take you somewhere, and by Seminary Co-op Bookstores. For readers, the Seminary Co-op Bookstores are a literary slice of heaven, because this consumer-owned bookstore is actually three Chicago bookstores. The flagship store at 5757 South University Avenue, widely regarded as one of the world's best academic bookstores, carries about 200,000 titles. Currently, they recommend Your Inner Fish, A Journey into the 3.5 Billion-Year History of the Human Body by Neil Shubin, published by Pantheon. 57th Street Books at 1301 East 57th Street is a charming neighborhood bookstore that's featuring Sarah Paretsky's Bleeding Kansas, published by G.P. Putnam's. and the Newberry Library Bookshop at 60 West Walton, specializing in cartography, music, history, cards, gifts, and more. Discover Mapping Manifest Destiny, Chicago and the American West, by Michael Konzen and Diane Dillon, published by the Newberry Library. Enjoy Seminary Co-op Bookstore's 10% member discounts, worldwide shipping, special order services, and author events. Seminary Co-op Bookstores, 3 Chicago bookstores with 1 world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456 and semcoop.com. Each month, the featured author of Writers on the Record will be the subject of a brief Q&A written by Victoria Lautman for Chicago Magazine. Both the magazine and 98.7 WFMT will announce upcoming interviews, which take place Sundays at noon at Looking Glass Theater. Our next broadcast of Writers on the Record takes place Sunday, March 9th, when Victoria Lautman talks with Richard Price about his book, Lush Life. If you'd like to be in the audience for that discussion, call 312-832-6789 to make a reservation. Admission is free. We return now to Chicago's Looking Glass Theater and our live broadcast of Writers on the Record. Today, Victoria Lautman has been discussing the book, The Reserve, with its author, Russell Banks.
Welcome back to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. I'm talking to Russell Banks today about his 11th novel, The Reserve. I'm sure you're familiar with any one of his dozens, it seems like, of other books: Continental Drift, Affliction, Sweet Hereafter, The Rule of the Bone, Cloud Splitter, The Darling. Those are just his novels, and of course some of them were made into really incredible movies. Affliction, The Sweet Hereafter, both of them were really fantastic. And Russell, as we'll hear a little bit later on, is hard at work on several screenplays for even more of these books to become movies. The book, and I want to also remind people, this is a good place to do it, although it's kind of breaking the train of thought here, that mark your calendars for the next two Writers on the Records. Richard Price will be here talking about his new book on March 9th, Elizabeth Strout on April 20th. You can reserve seats for those now. One of the other important characters in this book is one of the guides from the reserve, one of these Adirondack guides. He's a third-generation guide, and his name is Hubert St. Germain. And he, like a number of the other characters in the book, is straddling these two worlds, although it's very clear what his position is. He is a guide. He is hired as kind of like everybody's, you know, take us out and let's go shoot some ducks kind of person. But he decides to sort of trade up the way others of these characters are trading down. He has an affair with Jordan's wife. So everybody in this quadrilateral, it's a love quadrilateral, basically. Mm-hmm. Everybody's kind of shifting their focus from class, and nobody seems to really have a very good idea of what they're doing and why. And even though I think that Hubert at first seems like the most level-headed character of the group, by the end, we realize he is just as confused about himself as mm-hmm. everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the novel in some ways is a slow stripping away of illusions that all four of these characters have, illusions about class, about culture, about power, economic and otherwise, and about gender too. They begin with conventional illusions about them, American dream kind of dreaming illusions, and then by the end of the novel, they all have reluctantly lost most of those illusions, and in the process, they'll come to know themselves, each of them, much better. I think in the end, they know. I mean, that's part and parcel of self-knowledge, I suppose, as access to self-knowledge comes through losing your illusions about other people, too, and about your own motives in relating to them and so forth.
I want you to read from one of these passages that represent the flight into the future, where we see what our characters are doing, and flight is, I didn't even mean that, it's sort of no pun intended, but the whole idea of flight seems to be a leitmotif in the book. Jordan's flying a plane, the Hindenburg makes a very important appearance.
Yeah, actually it does. It did from the inception. I wanted to describe as much of this world as I could from above, both literally and metaphorically, from above and outside, and even took flying lessons myself and flew over this whole area as much as I could just to be able to write about it. But this is an important sequence that later takes place in Spain. At breakfast on the morning of April 5, 1937, the big American, the one they called Rembrandt, announced to the others that today's mission would be his last. He told them that he'd had enough. Tomorrow he was going to Madrid. He intended to stay at the Hotel Florida with the American journalist Matthews and the novelists Hemingway and Dos Passos and the photographer Capa. He claimed they were friends of his. He said that he wanted to make pictures of the war to help raise money back in the States. He was an artist, he said to them, not a soldier, and could do more for the anti-fascist cause with his pictures than by machine-gunning men in trenches from the air, which he said was like shooting ducks in a barrel. Anyone could do that. They didn't need him for it. The other pilots said nothing. He told them he didn't care if he was breaking his contract with the Republic of Spain. The government could keep his back pay and whatever signing bonus they still owed him. He'd had enough and wanted to be able to sleep at night without seeing bodies exploding in the air. The others seemed not to mind. They went on eating breakfast. The big American was the least popular man in the unit and had been from the start. Finally, Fairhead spoke. He said if this was to be Grove's last mission, he might as well lead it himself. An hour later, they were in the air in a V of V formation, with the departing American leading the point patrol. They had their Russian monoplanes now, the Polikarpov I-16s that the Spanish called Moscas. There were heavy rain squalls and a low ceiling of about 1,500 feet. They crossed the line at Brihuega, where the Italians had attempted to cut their way to Torija, and began the bombing run against the lines of tanks parked alongside the valley road. The big American dropped his bombs on the tanks, and the rest of the pilots did the same, and they destroyed many of them. Then Fairhead, who led the right patrol, waggled the wings of his aircraft and pointed up, and to their left, where there was a squadron of Fiat single-seat CR-32s, no match for the speed and armaments of the Russian monoplanes. The pilots put their Moscas into a sharp right echelon and began climbing, closing fast on the Fiats. There were seven of the Italians, and then, still higher, another five. When the airplanes engaged, formation flying was no longer possible. They broke into one-on-one dogfights, making passing side shots mainly as they tried to position themselves behind their targets. The Moscas began to take advantage of their superior maneuverability and climbing speed. The big American got himself in on the tail of the lead Fiat and fired his 20-millimeter cannons for 15 seconds straight, sending the Italian spinning downward, spilling a trail of water, gasoline, and black smoke. The American quickly dove after a second target 1,000 feet below, but the Italian saw him coming and turned away and dove in the opposite direction. The American curled back in pursuit, but after a few moments, the Fiat managed to elude him in the low clouds. When the American broke through the clouds at about 5,000 feet, he looked up and saw five Fiats diving towards him. He plunged back down into the clouds again, and with the Fiats close behind, carved a sharp left vertical bank and completed a 360-degree turn, bringing him in behind his pursuers, firing both machine guns steadily and scattering all five of the Fiats in different directions. A few moments later, when he emerged below the clouds again, he found himself in unfamiliar territory, mountainous, with the tops of the mountains in clouds. He was alone in the sky. He dropped down into a valley, hoping for some sign, a river or a road or a village that would help him read his map. As he moved along a rough valley cut with arroyos and narrow dry stream beds, he spotted too late an anti-aircraft gun emplacement in among the trees. At that instant, before he heard the sound of the gun, or saw the white puff of smoke in front of his airplane, or the second off to his right, a third shell struck his airplane. It hit the left side of the fuselage behind the cockpit, and he could no longer fly the airplane. He was bleeding badly from his shattered left thigh and ankle, and then another shell hit the airplane, this time in the cowling, smashing the engine, igniting the fuel, and instantly the airplane flipped onto its back and began its spiraling plummet to the ground.
Russell Banks. Nobody comes out of this unscathed.
Yeah, I know. You know, some people have said this is a departure from my previous novels where everybody ends up really badly. But actually, everybody ends up pretty badly in this one,
pretty
too.
Badly. and you know, it's really the way you handle your characters, whether it's Vanessa's father, Vanessa's mother, Vanessa herself. I mean, everybody is so profoundly wounded, either just psychologically or physically. Mm-hmm. And the idea of lobotomies in this book, which is a whole subtext, was just something that fascinated me. And I actually went and thought, well, who was this guy? Is this a real person? Is this based on somebody like Rockwell Kent? And there were some very famous people living in a similar community who were early proponents of lobotomies. And how did you bring that into all of this?
Well, it's an interesting metaphor in a way, getting into people's heads. We say that sometimes in a cliched way, but we mean, you know, getting in, influencing and changing people's ideas, thoughts, attitudes, and so forth. And lobotomy is the very physical embodiment of that, of course. It goes with the territory as well. That period, in the middle 30s, it was considered the most advanced technique for dealing with psychosis and personality disorders of the type that Vanessa herself, bad behavior, you know, especially in women. And so it wasn't a big leap for me to see that. It began with her father being a brain surgeon, and then you feel, well, what kind of brain surgeon would he be? And then you think, this would be interesting, and this is a lively metaphor for what's going on amongst these characters as well. And the cruelty of it, the assumptions that lie behind it, that surgically you can alter a person's, you have the right to surgically alter a person's personality and life consciousness, really, was useful for me in telling the story. I could have written the novel just about that, but it would have been just about that. And I wanted, again, to make it contextual, to make it part of the world that they were living in, as well as make it part of the plot structure, which it is. It's a very big part of the plot.
You know, before we run out of time and begin taking questions, I think it's also important to point out that you do put your money where your mouth is, so to speak, and that is to say, in your own life, you know, you've been an incredible success. You've been a, you know, renowned teacher. You've done all of these things that have made you a success. But you've also applied your success to helping other writers. And you, since 2003, have been the founder and the president of the Cities of Refuge in North America, which is an organization that provides asylum for dissident writers from all over the world. Ithaca, Las Vegas, Santa Fe, and Pittsburgh, I think, are the main ones.
Two in Mexico City, and then we are trying to expand from that base in the United States. There are about 30 cities of asylum, cities of refuge, they're called variously, in Europe as well. And basically what they are safe houses for writers who are under threat in other parts of the world. And the writer, the city itself provides the house and the living stipend for up to 2 years for a writer who's maybe an exile, it might be fleeing from persecution, or but can't go home again is the main thing, and hasn't a base. So it's a very useful thing to do for writers. It's all, by the way, I should say, created by writers for writers. It began in 1994 with Salman Rushdie, was the first president in the European program, and then Wally Szczepanik the second, and then I became the president. That was the international, and brought it to the United States as well.
And it sounds as though from the website there are hundreds of authors who have applied to have this asylum, but not enough places for them. And I think of all the writers who don't make that step, who aren't helping. I mean, it's not for everybody to do that, but you have often been on the side of kind of the underdog.
Yeah, but you know, it's actually, I think, more an expression of the fact that as I've grown older, I've come to think of myself less and less as a strictly American writer, but rather as a member of a much larger community of writers than that, you know, an international cadre. What binds me, I feel as close to a writer from China, for instance, as I do to John Updike, who's another living white male writer from New England.
pretty good one, too, yeah.
Pretty good one, right. And so, you know, that Chinese writer and I are doing the same thing, as far as I'm concerned. And he's a member of my clan, you know, and I want to support that person. I happen to live in the West, you know, in North America, and so binding myself together with writers in North America, with writers in Western Europe, we were able to achieve this and help writers from, you know, Sierra Leone during the Sierra Leone Civil War, Liberia, from the Middle East, and from Chechnya and places like that as well.
So if we wanted to establish something like that in Chicago, what does it just take, some good-hearted person?
It would take probably a collaboration of, private philanthropy, corporate support, university support, arts organizations. Usually that's what happens. Mm. They come together through some central organizing group, usually an arts organization, and just check the website, www.citiesofrefugenorthamerica.org.
Now, it's sort of unusual. You're also being so involved in the process of turning your books into films. I can't think of another writer who has got four screenplays going, or maybe...
Well, I bet you there's a lot of them out there.
Well, not successfully. Two of them are with Scorsese.
In development, yeah.
They can't quite boast of that. Yeah. You have really taken to Hollywood, or maybe it's just that you want to have more control over the process and have the talent to be able to turn your own books into a screenplay, which I think a lot of writers actually have a great deal of trouble with.
Well, it's a completely different kind of activity than writing fiction, certainly, and you have to know that to begin with, and then you have to be adept at it, too. But I got in sort of by accident. I never intended to. It was really in the making of The Sweet Hereafter and Affliction that I got drawn into it, because the directors of those two films, was Adam McGoyan, the Canadian, and Paul Schrader, gave me a kind of crash course in filmmaking when I was in my late 50s, and I thought, this is really fun, you know. These are really smart people doing something very interesting, trying to make a work of art that's also at a mass audience, which is almost impossible to do. And it sort of brought me into it, and there was a side of my personality that really loves collaboration. For many years I taught universities, and that's a kind of collaboration, but I had stopped teaching by the middle 90s, and so I seem to have filled that time by getting involved in filmmaking.
You know, this is a good moment. Those in the audience who'd like to ask a question, come on down to one of the two microphones here. Do not be shy. He really likes to have people ask questions. He told me that, and we'll try and get to all of them. And in the meanwhile, as people are lining up, okay, now I can say this because we're such good friends after this lovely interview. But if you also were to Google at this point, cheesy histrionic novel, you know, Russell Banks' name would come up there too, because of this terribly, I thought, very personal review in the New York Times. I thought it was interesting that this book, it didn't even really polarize authors. It didn't get all great reviews, but there were a lot of really great reviews of this book, and the Kakutani review in the New York Times, which paralleled a number of earlier ones of her work that she reviewed, that seemed almost like a personal attack. And do you care? Does it matter?
Well, I've forgotten who said it, but maybe it was Auden or somebody. He said, a bad review can ruin your breakfast, but you don't want to let it ruin your lunch. And and I felt that way when I woke up. I woke up that Tuesday morning. It was publication date, and read the review, and it really was like getting poked with a stick in the eye for about 2 hours. And then I reread it, and it was so over the top that it looked comical to me. It was funny, and then it put a kind of spring in my step. I've been savaged by Michiko Kakutani, along with, you know, Don DeLillo over the last few years, and Doris Lessing, and Joyce Carol Oates, and
Martin Amis, half of the
best writers in the world that she's reviewed. So it was really a kind of a promotion for me to a club.
Let's take a couple of questions here, sir.
Next year will be the 150th anniversary of John Brown's raid and your Cloud Splitter. I wanted to know, are you thinking of a screenplay about that? And where did Cloud Splitter come from?
Cloud Splitter is the novel, of course, about based on the life of John Brown, he of Harper's Ferry, and so on. HBO is making a film adaptation of it, and I wrote a draft of the screenplay, and then there's another writer making it. The director is a man named Raoul Peck, whose most recent film for HBO was a film called Sometimes in April about the Rwanda genocide. A wonderful Haitian director I'm working with on another film as well. And Martin Scorsese is executive producing it. So we're in process. The strike isn't quite over yet, so we got stalled over the writer's strike. So that's where it's going. Your other part of your question was, where does Cloud Splitter come from? The word itself, you mean?
No, where did your writing of it come from?
Oh, it came from a lot of different sources, but the answer to the trivia question, where does John Brown's body lie moldering, is North Elba, New York. And that's just down the road from my house in the Adirondacks region of New York. And he's buried there along with 11 other young men who were either killed at Harper's Ferry or were executed afterwards and bodies were brought back. So his ghost haunts the valley I live in. And I could not avoid it when I moved there in 1987 until the late 90s when I finally sat down and wrote the novel.
Thank you. Another question.
Hi, this may be a blasphemous question, so forgive me in advance.
Blasphemy on Sunday.
On Sunday, no less. You were talking earlier about kind of the noirish tone of some of your work and how it kind of correlates to, you know, class issues and a lot of things. And I was curious, there's some modern writers like, Dennis Lehane who write books mm-hmm. on a much more, maybe a micro version of that. And I was curious whether you saw address some of those same issues again in a more narrow sense in a single city or environment. I was curious whether you saw those as related to the kind of work you do, and if there were any of those kinds of authors that you thought were interesting or valuable.
Oh, yeah. I think Lehane is a very good example of a writer that I admire for his take on, the kind of underside of mostly urban life, Boston for the most part. Richard Price, who you've got coming here next week, is one of my favorite writers in America today in my generation, who's just chosen to work, you know, both sides of the racial divide, both sides of the class divide, most of it in, you know, New Jersey, New York area, but who's a brilliant writer. There seem to be a number of writers now in the United States who of my generation and maybe a little younger, who have been willing to go ahead and see fiction with a political dimension. And the very much younger writers don't seem quite that interested in it, and the older generation isn't that interested in it. But.
We have another question here.
Mm-hmm. Hi. Very much enjoy in some of your novels how historical events are done with psychological events. I was curious, current events now, if you think that there's anything going on where there's transformative figures among the contemporary scene in things that are going on now.
Transformative human individuals like historical figures you're talking about?
Yeah, I'm thinking particularly about how you give John Brown a real personality and also how society was being transformed from one thing to another.
Right.
And sometimes I think about current scene in historical context.
Well, of course, September 11th is the big hinge on which our era seems to turn, and a lot of writers have tried to write fiction that that is centered in that event, and I think for the most part it's failed as fiction, and it's had a journalistic quality perhaps that's dominated it. I think the best way to write about contemporary events of that magnitude is to try to step outside it as much as possible. And usually the way to do that for a fiction writer is to step back in time. So if you think of John Brown, writing about John Brown, I wasn't really writing about John Brown alone. I was trying to write about terrorism in our time and the intersection of violence and religion in our time. By writing about it in the interest of freeing the slaves, John Brown's use of violence, free the slave. In a way, I could write more clearly and think more clearly about terrorism, say the terrorists being forms of terrorism being used by at that time when I was writing, anti-abortionists, for instance, were shooting up clinics, bombing clinics and shooting doctors, that sort of thing. Or in this case, the Hindenburg and its going down was a way for me to think about and imagine 9/11. There are only 33 people killed in the Hindenburg, but when I say the word Hindenburg, everybody has the same picture in their head because it was broadcast live. It's the first tragic event of that ilk that was broadcast live when it happened by radio, actually from a Chicago radio station, and then by Saturday it was in every newsreel in every theater in America, which was how people got their news. So it was felt as though everyone experienced it, but only 33 people were killed in it, which is really kind of shocking when you think. So that cast a shadow forward in time over 9/11. For me, it was easier for me to get at what really may have happened in 9/11 by stepping back in time and writing about another disaster.
Interesting.
Oh, the humanity, right?
Yeah, that's right. Those are the final words of that broadcast. Oh, the humanity.
I don't know a lot about her, but was Jane Mason one of the figures that you drew on?
And maybe you could talk a little bit about her. You wouldn't know that name unless you knew a lot about her. Jane Mason was a woman that Hemingway had an affair with in Havana in the mid-30s, and who later became the model for the dark woman in The Short Happy Life of Frances McComber, and probably also was a figure who stood in for The Snows of Kilimanjaro, the wife in that. It was an unhappy love affair for him, but she was a figure. I got interested in her in a way, and she was a remarkable, beautiful, slightly cracked woman. And I just thought, you know, a guy like Hemingway, a guy like me, we could fall for someone like that.
Well, and I hate to point it out, but you fell 4 times.
Yes.
And I presume one of them was like that. You've been married now for quite a while to the beloved, as she's called. In
20 years.
The dedication page. You have 4 daughters. Your life, I mean, I wish that perhaps we will get an autobiography at some point, because it reads so much like a great book, a great movie. You know, imagining you at 16 as pretty much the head of your family, the oldest of your siblings, just leaving for 3 months to California, and then, you know, later to try and go up and try to get to Cuba and fight alongside, you know, the dissidents there, and then kind of getting stuck in Florida. I mean, you've had an extraordinary life.
Yeah, I thought my life was over by the time I was 21, because I had done all that, and then I'd also been married and fathered a child and been divorced, and I was 21 years old. There was nothing left to do, I thought. And I was trapped moving furniture around in a hotel in South Florida. So
when you said writing saved your life, was it around that point or a little bit later?
It's around that point I began writing seriously. And when I say writing saved my life, I mean, as you can tell just from that précis, that I was a turbulent and chaotic and angry and confused young man. But because of writing, I had to apply to my life a kind of rigor and discipline, kind of attention and intelligence and honesty that forced me to abstain and back away from what was clearly a kind of self-destructive arc. And you know, it might have been, I could have also gone off and entered a Zen monastery for 10 years, and maybe that might have provided some of the same rigor and discipline. But the truth of the matter is, writing forced me to be intelligent, more intelligent and more honest, and more aware of other people than anything else in my life.
Do you think that knowing yourself as well as you do now has made you a better writer, or, I hate to, maybe you can't answer this really, but, or not as good writer?
Well, I tell you, most of the time I'm not that honest and I'm not that smart and I'm really sort of self-absorbed. But when I'm writing, I am honest and I'm not self-absorbed. I'm thinking of others and I'm fairly intelligent. So I don't think that having gotten older and having got a little, I won't say wiser, but more experienced and more self-knowledge than I had when I was young has helped me as a writer. It's the process of writing itself and the demands of writing itself has made me a better writer.
Well, I think we've been very, very lucky to have the most important living white male author here at Writers on the
Record. You know, is there a shelf at the Barnes & Noble and Borders, a little department where they say that?
It's only got your books on it, dude. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure, Russell Banks. Well, thank you. We'll see you all here next month.
Thank you.
The people at Maven Chronicles and at Seminary Co-op Bookstores hope you've enjoyed today's broadcast of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, which will return on Sunday, March 9th, when Victoria's guest will be Richard Price, author of Lush Life. If you'd like to be in the audience for that discussion, call 312-832-6789 to make a reservation. Admission is free. Our special thanks to everyone at Looking Glass Theater, including Executive Director Rachel Kraft and House Manager Chad Wachob. Thanks also to Chicago Magazine, including Editor Richard Babcock. Eric Arunis is the audio engineer for Writers on the Record. Steve Robinson is the executive producer. The host and producer for Writers on the Record is Victoria Lautman. Broadcasts of Writers on the Record are made possible in part by MavenChronicles.com. Let them take you somewhere. And by Seminary Co-op Bookstores, three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456. After more than 50 years, Ico's Art Materials will be closing its doors forever in early April of this year. Almost all items are currently discounted 20% or more. Ico's beautiful papers, books, folk arts, and crafts are selling quickly. Come in early for best selection. Ico's Art Materials. For beautiful Japanese paper and fine handcrafted items to inspire and delight, is located at 3347 North Clark Street in Chicago. 773-404-5600. You're tuned to 98.7 WFMT Chicago and on the internet at WFMT.com.